Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Congress, as usual, is taking its own sweet time. An update on the looming deadlines. What Americans really think about government and big business. Also, today, the common toaster. How hard can it be to heat up a piece of bread? Pretty hard, actually. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be with us for the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 14th of December, which means there are just 10 shopping days until Christmas, 17 days till the end of the year, and something like 48 hours until the government runs out of money. Again. I know, we've been here before, right? But it does seem like this time the threat of a government shutdown just kind of snuck up on us. It is the first in a rolling series of time pressures Congress is facing as it tries to wrap things up for the year, and we do know how lawmakers love them, some deadlines. We've gotten Marketplace's David Gura on the line from Washington to bring us up to date on the happenings. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so let's take this chronologically, I guess, in order of looming deadlines. The government runs out of money on Friday, which would seem to be a fairly large deadline. What are they doing about this? What's Congress doing about it?
Well, this is the way they've been budgeting here in Washington now for the past couple of months. They keep passing these short-term extensions for funding, and they did that again. So that one runs out on Friday. Negotiators have actually come together, both Republicans and Democrats from the House and the Senate. They've come up with a bill to keep the government funded until October of next year. Few little details to hammer out, but really the big issue here is when are they going to vote on that spending bill?
All right. So to be clear, nothing's been voted on, right? So
that's right.
Okay. What's in these things? I mean, there must be some kind of hang up someplace.
All right. So this is, you know, an extension of funding as it is, but there are also sort of riders or provisions in there that would change sort of how agencies are funded. Agencies that enforce Dodd-Frank, enforce financial reform, they'd see cuts to their budget. Also, some cuts to the Education Department, to one of President Obama's biggest education initiatives, Race to the Top. So it's not totally straight ahead. There's stuff in here that would change how parts of the federal government are funded.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's the first deadline. That's Friday, the government running out of money. Assuming we solve that one, there's another one they're working on. That's the extension of unemployment benefits and the payroll tax cut, which is valid through the end of the year, right? So where are we with that?
Just a couple weeks left there. So the payroll tax cut affects about 160 million Americans. And yesterday, the House voted to extend that payroll tax cut. It's to be a one-year extension. But there's stuff in that extension that Democrats don't like. So a number of EPA regulations would be scaled back. And there's this really big stumbling block, and that is Republicans want the president to decide really soon, within 60 days, whether or not to build this oil pipeline that goes from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico.
This is the Keystone XL, right?
That's right. Yeah. So he said that decision won't get made till 2013. They say, look, this has the potential to create a lot of jobs. Let's do that sooner rather than later. Democrats have said that's a non-starter. This bill, if it includes that Keystone XL provision, dead on arrival in the Senate, the president said he's going to veto it. What Democrats want to do is pay for the payroll tax cut extension by taxing millionaires.
Right. Are the unemployment benefits in that same bill?
They are, but the House said they want to extend those. But the maximum amount of time you could get unemployment benefits right now, that's 99 weeks. Yeah. They want to scale that down to 59 weeks max.
And just to put a point on it, they want to get out of there for the holidays, right? I mean, they're leaving town on Friday?
That's right. Their vacation's supposed to start on Friday. Yeah. I think there's consensus here. That's probably not going to happen. They're probably going to have to work through the weekend, Kai.
All righty. David Gura in Washington on the State of Congress. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Here's another story about which you can fairly say we've been here before. The state of California is looking at another round of budget cuts. Turns out a rosy forecast of state revenues last summer was just a couple of billion dollars too rosy. And higher education once again finds itself on the chopping block. California's two public university systems are each going to have to trim another $100 million from their budgets. And while the size of the cuts is all California, that is big, the situation is everywhere. And as usual, students and their families are probably going to end up paying the price. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
Tuition at California's public universities already jumped about 20% this year. That's helped fuel campus protests, like the one at UC Davis, where students were doused with pepper spray. Steve Boylard is with the Legislative Analyst's Office in Sacramento. He says Cal State and the University of California don't plan to raise tuition again this year.
But they have suggested that if these cuts are not restored for next year, they would then seek tuition as a way to replace that funding.
The latest cuts will hit community college students, though. They'll pay an extra $10 per credit next year, almost 30% more. And what's happening in California is playing out all over the country. 28 states have cut higher education funding this fiscal year. Many schools have leaned on students to make up for it.
The easiest thing to do is increase tuition.
That's Joni Finney, a professor of higher education at the University of Pennsylvania. She says tuition is rising while family income is falling. Students who do manage to get to college find that classes they need have been cut, so it takes longer to graduate.
The big impact is that a generation of students will probably be less educated than the generation before.
Universities are making up some of the difference with more financial aid. Just today, UC Berkeley announced a new program to help middle-class families pay for college. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, everybody, raise your hand if you know off the top of your head the name of the world's biggest door-to-door cosmetics company. Anybody? Well, Avon has been struggling of late, and now it's looking for a new chief executive. Andrea Jung, the longest-serving woman until now CEO of a Fortune 500 company, is going to stay on as chairwoman of the board. But our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains there are some questions being raised about Avon's famous 125-year-old business model.
Avon calling.
It's been a long time since Avon has used that old slogan. The company improved its sales by giving itself a younger, more upscale image makeover and expanding overseas. It's been especially successful with its door-to-door marketing model in Britain and takes in more than 80% of its revenue from outside the U.S. Lately, though, it's stumbled badly in Brazil and China, and its financial performance has been erratic. Kent Grayson is a marketing professor at Northwestern University. He doesn't see Avon's troubles as a sign that its approach is outdated. He suggests Avon just isn't adapting to the challenges it faces, particularly in growing its business abroad.
They sell products to different kinds of customers in different markets, and the executives have to relate to those different kinds of customers in different ways. These kinds of problems are problems that any big global company has, regardless of their distribution model.
At the University of Illinois at Chicago, direct selling expert Charles King says overall the marketing through networking industry has been thriving, in spite of or perhaps due to the tough economy. Companies like Mary Kay Cosmetics and Amway.
More and more people are trying to get involved in having their own business as an alternative income stream.
King says direct selling and network marketing accounts for $118 billion in sales worldwide, and online sales are no immediate threat as he sees it.
When it comes to me convincing you and explaining to you, word of mouth, person to person, is the most powerful.
The experts say Avon doesn't need to abandon its approach, just fix it. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Boy, the euro had a lousy day, oil had a lousy day, gold had a lousy day, Wall Street had a lousy day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
The topic of the day for our new partnership with Gallup Attitude Check, in which we find out what the American people really think about things, is honesty. Which profession or industry we think is the most honest? Nurses are number one. Journalists, for those who are interested, rank between funeral directors and real estate agents. I don't know what's up with that. On the broader topics of the relative honesty of government versus big business, while members of Congress are among the lowest, right down there with lobbyists and car salesmen, business as a whole does a bit better. Here to talk about what it all means is Gallup's editor-in-chief, Frank Newport. Frank, good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
So let me take those honesty figures and turn them a little bit sideways and ask you if we can interpret them to mean who we dislike more, big business versus big government. Is that a fair juxtaposition?
I think it can be looked at in that fashion because we actually, Kai, have some separate questions where we've asked just that. We didn't say, do you like or dislike big government or big business? But one of the questions that we've been asking long before my time since the 60s is, what's the biggest threat to the country? To the future of the country, big business, big government, or big labor? And when we ask it that way, big government right now overwhelms everybody else. 64% of Americans say that's the biggest threat, and business is way down there at just 26%.
Let me take that then and run with it and say, if Occupy Wall Street, which does not favor big business, and the Tea Party, which does not favor big government, if they were to have some face-off in the next political year, as is entirely possible, what would that look like? Who would win, if you will?
All of our data suggests that the Tea Party would win. And I say that because we have data point after data point showing just how worried Americans are about government, the low esteem they hold government, how, as we just talked about, they think big government is a threat. The image of the federal government, those three words, the federal government, is below any other business and industry sector we test, including the oil and gas industry and real estate, which typically been very low. People don't have any love lost for big business, but anytime we look at comparable measures, we find right now Americans are more worried about big government, I would say, which is the Tea Party theme to some degree, than they are big business, which is Occupy Wall Street.
Right. But I was intrigued by the next line item in your survey, the results of which I saw anyway, the brief that I saw, which is that people basically don't think it makes a difference as to what's going to happen in this country, whether a Democrat or a Republican is elected.
Well, that was very specific about the solving the country's economic problems, because all of our data show, as you well know, that that's the dominant problem that's going to be in the election this year. All our data show that it's the number one issue. So we said, does it make a difference? And actually, major difference, less than half, just in the 40% of Americans say a major difference, which means the majority of Americans say whether it's a Democrat or Republican at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is going to be a minor or no difference at all in terms of solving the country's economic problems.
You guys don't measure this sort of stuff, or maybe you do, I don't know. But what will it say about turnout next fall then, if people just go, eh, it doesn't matter?
Well, people have been cynical for quite a while, so we'll have to see. What it really, of course, to us who look at political data means is there going to be differential turnout. And typically the people on the outs, that would be the Tea Party, the conservatives who are most worried about who's in, are more motivated. We saw that in 2010, so our early predictions now are that the Republicans are going to have a turnout advantage because they've got more of the anger on their part than the Democrats.
Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief at Gallup. Frank, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Our partnership with Gallup is called Attitude Check, and you can check out the numbers behind the radio story on our website, marketplace.org. Click on Attitude Check. President Obama went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina today. It's the latest in a series of public events marking the end of the war in Iraq. American troops are going to be gone by New Year's Eve, but plenty of Americans will still be there. Diplomats working at and thousands of contractors guarding the U.S. Embassy. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
State Department staff will be staying on when U.S. troops pull out of Iraq, but they certainly won't be alone.
An overall diplomatic presence in 2012 will be about 15,000 to 16,000.
That's State Department spokesman Mark Toner at a briefing earlier this month. And yeah, you heard him right. He said 15,000 to 16,000 people will be working in Iraq under the auspices of the State Department. No small number. John Pike heads up the military information website, globalsecurity.org.
That's got to be 10 times bigger than any other American embassy, the equivalent of the total embassy staff of every other American embassy on the planet.
And all but 2,000 of them will be contractors. Contractors will guard the massive U.S. embassy in Baghdad, as well as several consulates in Iraq. They'll ferry diplomats around in helicopters and treat them in State Department hospitals. Todd Harrison is a defense analyst at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He says contractors will also be in charge of logistics.
Food, clean water, you name it. You know, all the things that you need to support a miniature, you know, army of 15,000 people.
That miniature army will be operating on a shoestring. The State Department budget request for 2012 includes only around $5 billion for operations in Iraq, a fraction of the $46 billion Harrison says we spent this year. Dov Zakheim was an undersecretary of defense in the administration of George W. Bush. He wonders if that's enough for proper oversight.
The state really only has a couple of auditors out there. It's a large country, all these contractors all over the place. Who's going to see what they're doing? I don't know how state's going to do it.
One way state could do it, hire more contractors to supervise all the other contractors. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, the advanced technology of toast for breakfast.
inside this toaster that had only cost £4, I kind of worked out that it was made of about 400 different bits.
But first, let's do the numbers. A weaker euro plus cheaper oil today equaled falling stock prices. The Dow Industrial stumbled 131 points, down 1.1%, closed at 11,823. The blue chips did. The Nasdaq off 39 points, 1.5%, 2539 at the bell. The S&P 500 shed 13 points, 1.1%, signed off at 1211. Price of oil drained nearly 5% today on concerns that Europe hasn't quite contained its debt crisis. Energy stocks fell with it. Chevron down nearly 3%. Exxon dropped 1.3%. Tech stocks also lost a step. Cisco Systems powered down 2.75%. Hewlett-Packard chipped off 1.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.90% even. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for November. A Senate subcommittee on oceans, atmosphere, fisheries, and Coast Guard discusses the environmental risks of genetically engineered fish. The chief concern? What happens if they escape into wild habitats? And Golden Globe nominations are announced in Beverly Hills. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and time now for A Moment with John. John Buckley is our foreign editor here to talk about the European news of the day. And John, we begin, as most things Europe do these days, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. The Gates.
Angela Merkel, most of the German papers today were reporting that Angela Merkel has been making a major speech to lawmakers in Berlin. In that speech, she did say that Britain, which, as you know, didn't sign up to that deal with the rest of the European Union nations last week, remains a key member of the European Union and a vital part of it. So some consolation there, perhaps, for David Cameron, the British Prime Minister.
Well, let's go to Mr. Cameron for a second, because he said no, famously, last week, and it's standing him in good stead.
It is. The British press today is reporting a poll by Reuters Ipsos Mori, which is saying that support for Cameron's party, the Conservatives, rose by 7 percentage points to 41% for the first time this year. Support for the centre-left Labour Party slipped to 39%. So very good news. And it does show that that Euroscepticism, however it's viewed in the mainland of Europe, in continental Europe, always goes down well with a British audience.
All right. So you have 8 seconds left in our segment. What does it all mean for the solution of the problem? Ready, go.
The solution of the problem, much reported as a done deal last week, has a ways to go.
John Buckley, our foreign editor. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Guy.
So as John was saying, the solution to the debt crisis in Europe has a long way to go. We've got our own problems over here, though, and we all know what they are. Commentator Robert Reich says Europe should definitely be among them.
As the European debt crisis worsens, our big problem won't be dwindling exports to Europe. Our increasing exports to China and South and Central America will help cushion that blow, as will lower borrowing costs here in the United States. Europeans and others worried about where to park their savings are buying up treasury bills. No, our biggest problem will be big Wall Street banks with significant exposure to European banks. This is what we need to worry about. New data released last week by European banking regulators shows growing odds of European banks suffering losses tied to European government bonds. As Europe comes ever closer to the precipice of a Greek default, those bonds are worth less and less, which means Wall Street is sitting on a pile of European bank IOUs, credit default swaps, derivatives, and lots of other paper that's becoming riskier with every passing day. But no one knows the extent of the exposure of our banks to European banks because, believe it or not, we're still back to where we were before 2008, when no one knew much of anything about the interconnectedness of all these financial players. Investors in Wall Street banks are guessing it's pretty bad, which is why stocks of major U.S. banks are down 20% this year, by far the worst performers in the S&P 500. The S&P is down for the year, but would be up over 3% if financial stocks were excluded. But wasn't the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation supposed to fix this? That was the intent, but Wall Street lobbyists made sure Dodd-Frank didn't work. For one thing, the law diffused responsibility for financial oversight across 10 different agencies instead of a single Federal Reserve. And none of these agencies is taking real responsibility for avoiding systemic risk. In addition, Dodd-Frank left the biggest Wall Street banks bigger than they were before, way too big to fail. So if things go very badly in Europe, the end game of the European debt crisis for America could easily be another Wall Street bailout. Not a very nice way to ring in 2012.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Do send us your thoughts, marketplace.org. Click on contact. Most of us are actually quite fine, not understanding a lot of the technology that we're surrounded by. We just want to know that it works. Tablet computers, smartphones, whatever. London-based designer Thomas Thwaites isn't satisfied with that, so he challenged himself to take something that we use every day, or most of us use every day, and try to build it from scratch. He chose a toaster. No, not high-tech, but complicated enough. It took him 9 months, a saga he chronicles in a book called The Toaster Project. And so the first thing I had to ask him when we talked was, why?
Yeah, that is a good question. I think I was motivated to try and work out a bit how that transformation from rock into, you know, toaster or microphone or laptop or whatever, you know, how that transformation took place.
Well, and so the first thing you did actually was a little reverse engineering, right? You took one apart?
Yeah. I went and bought the cheapest toaster I could find, which was only like £4 from the high street. And inside this toaster that had only cost £4, I kind of, you know, worked out that it was made of about 400 different bits, you know. That's wow. When you take the capacitors apart and then the bits inside the capacitors. And how can you buy that level of complexity for, you know, the price of, right, for, you know, a drink in a fancy bar in London, yeah, kind
six,
of thing.
Six bucks, whatever it is. Here's the thing, though. You said you wanted to build it from scratch, which, you know, if you're thinking of, let's say, baking a cake from scratch, that means you put the eggs in and you put the flour in. It doesn't mean you go out and grow a chicken from scratch and you don't do the wheat from the ground up. You went out and you smelted the ore and you went to the mines and you did all this stuff to really build this thing.
Yeah, I must say I had to compromise along the way, because although I could just about manage, you know, to extract copper from, you know, some kind of polluted water, which I took from a copper mine in Wales, and I just about, you know, managed to get iron out of iron ore, which I'd kind of dragged in a suitcase back from this iron mine. You know, when it came to sort of plastic, you know...
That was my favorite part. Yeah, you call it BP, yeah, so, to try to get some crude oil. Tell us, I mean, that's a great part of this book.
So I kind of remember from like my high school sort of science class that, you know, plastic comes from oil. So, right. You know, okay, I wanted to go to the source of oil. So I phoned up BP and spent, you know, about kind of half an hour on the phone to this guy in the PR office at BP, trying to convince him that it would be fantastic PR if BP, you know, would kind of fly me to an oil rig and let me have a jug of oil to then make plastic for my toaster. And I kind of think that they may have entertained the idea for about 10 seconds. But yeah, in the end, they said if I wanted an oil tanker full, it would be easier for them to help me.
Can I ask you, have you ever actually toasted a piece of bread in this thing?
I did try. I was put under immense social pressure to plug it in at a kind of event. And so I'd never been able to make any insulation for the wires. So I was really nervous. I was wearing rubber shoes.
Oh, no.
And then switched it on. And for the briefest of moments, it was toasting. There was, you know, the element was glowing bright red, but then, like a supernova, the element sort of got too hot and melted itself. And the bread, well, yeah, it was warm.
Oh, my goodness. Thomas Thwaites, his book is called The Toaster Project, or a heroic attempt to build a simple electric appliance from scratch. You can read part of it on our book blog. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. Thomas, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Colin.
We've got a slideshow of Thomas building this thing, and it is something. I'll tell you that. Looks nothing at all like a toaster. You can check it out, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a somewhat curious follow-up to the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico last year and Thomas Thwaites' quest for a bucket of crude oil from BP. The Interior Department held a big auction of oil leases in the Gulf of Mexico today, the first in a good long while. BP was the high bidder in 11 of them, $27 million, the balance due on that one. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow stumbled 131 points, down 1.1%. The NASDAQ off 39 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 shed 13 points, 1.1%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, department stores using nostalgia to get people in the door.
Before Macy's, it was Bamberger's. And I remember those days really well, which just makes me happy to be here.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.